This is the third day of this January 2011 seven-day session. And we'll resume reading from our text, The Collected Works of Chinhu, the 12th century Korean Zen master Chinhu, and it's translated with an introduction by Robert Buswell, Jr. We left off yesterday where he's talking to his monks in an address called Encouragement to Practice. And he was lamenting how much time the monks wasted pursuing fame and profit, greedy, angry, jealous, envious, conceited, heedless. Is it not tragic? He says. Then he continues, if we have wisdom, then we should be prudent and prompt the body and mind in our meditation practice. Knowing our own mistakes, we should endeavor to reform and discipline ourselves. From morning to evening, we should diligently cultivate and quickly leave behind all suffering. We need merely rely on the sincere words of the Buddhas and patriarchs as if they were a bright mirror reflecting the fact that our own minds have been brilliant and pure since the very beginning. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. And then there's a question. According to your explanation, we must first have faith and understanding in our own natures, our pure, sublime minds. Then we can rely on this nature in our cultivation of Zen. For ages, this has been the essential technique through which people have cultivated the Buddha mind and completed the path to Buddhahood. But why is it that most people who cultivate Zen are unable to display the wisdom of spiritual powers? If they have no penetrating power to manifest, how can their practice be in accord with reality? And Chinul's response, I laughed and said, the wisdom of spiritual powers depends upon the power of Dharma which derives from right faith in the Buddha mind. It is obtained by energetically applying oneself to amplified practice. It is like polishing a mirror. The more you wipe the dust away, the brighter it becomes. Finally, once the brightness is clear, images reflect in thousands of details. But if one's faith and understanding are incorrect, and one's efforts flag, or if one sits dozing in dullness and assumes that maintaining silence is Zen, how can spiritual powers possibly manifest? So just about this phrase, spiritual powers manifesting, the implication is that we, all of us, every one of us, is endowed with these spiritual powers. This is our birthright. Spiritual powers and our own fundamental mind of enlightenment. But the challenge is to get to actualize these things, to have them functioning in our lives instead of just in as potentialities. An ancient worthy once said, if you simply practice properly in regard to your own nature, you need not be concerned about the three knowledges and the six spiritual powers. And why? Because they are only secondary concerns of the sages. And then Chinlu says, the main concern now is to understand the mind and dig to the root. If you can get to the root, you need not worry about the branches. The six spiritual powers, there's no footnote here, but they're something like the ability to foresee the future, things like that, paranormal powers that can be byproducts of strong zazen. But what Chinyu is saying is what all of his predecessors and successors have said, is that that's not our business in Zen, trying to develop paranormal powers. Even samadhi itself is not an end in practice, but a means to an end. In Japan, samadhi, meaning this absolute power of concentration, samadhi has been elevated to having great value in its own right. At least that's my reading of it. I think it's just overstated, this value in samadhi. It's definitely is valuable as a means to awakening, but can become like a kind of a spiritual gymnastics to develop this force. And it gets away from the whole point of practice, which, to use the Buddha's famous words, he said, I teach but two things, suffering and the end of suffering. There are people in other disciplines, martial arts and other disciplines, who can have a great deal of samadhi power, but no insight into their nature, into the nature of reality. More here about samadhi and prajna. Now, he uses prajna in a way that we don't normally use it. It has this dual meaning. On the one hand, prajna can be understood as discriminating awareness, or analytical discriminating understanding. We use prajna, as in prajnaparamita, to mean transcendental wisdom. It has nothing to do with analysis. But I'm going to read this in fairness to our author here, because they're not unrelated either. He says, well, now he's quoting a previous master who in a text called True Records of Yi. It is said, the two words samadhi and prajna are an abbreviation for the threefold training, which in its complete form is called sila, samadhi, and prajna. We mentioned this a couple of days ago. These are the three essentials of practice. Sila is the precepts or upright conduct. Samadhi is concentration, and prajna is transcendental wisdom, or this other meaning. But he says, sila means to guard against wrong and bring evil to a halt. It prevents one from falling into the three evil borns. Those would be the three lowest of the six realms of unenlightened existence: hell, hungry ghosts, and animals. Samadhi means to come into accordance with the noumenon and absorb scatteredness. Okay, the noumenon is a very sophisticated philosophical term. Basically, it means the oneness of things, the absolute. So, in a state of samadhi, the mind is undivided. It's completely absorbed, and in a deep state of concentration beyond self and other, beyond all dualisms. Samadhi enables one to transcend the six desires. Prajna means that one critically investigates dharmas, dharmas means things, and contemplates their voidness. It marvelously leads out of birth and death. And then he says a little bit later, although the name and attributes of samadhi and prajna may differ, do not let your faith in them backslide. Conquer yourselves and achieve your aim. And then he quotes a commentary called The Perfection of Wisdom Shastra. Even in pursuing worldly affairs, if one does not devote oneself to them fully, those enterprises will not succeed. How much more so is this the case for one who is training in supreme bodhi but does not make use of samadhi? So even in business and sports and politics, to have strong powers of concentration, of course, will serve one a great deal. But he says, if even in these worldly pursuits, concentration is important, how much more so in the practice of the Dharma? And then he quotes a gatha, a verse. The adamantine armor of samadhi, adamantine means diamond hard, the adamantine armor of samadhi can stop the arrows of defilement. Samadhi is the storehouse for keeping wisdom. It is the field of merit for all good qualities. If the dust of the world hides the sun in the sky, a great rain can wash it away. If the wind of thought and imagination scatter the mind, samadhi can halt it. The word concentration comes from a root word meaning to bring together. This is why we sit in postures, when possible, we sit in postures where the limbs are drawn in toward the center of the body rather than splayed out, because when the limbs are pulled in toward the center of the body, the mind does likewise. It's easier to concentrate the mind when the limbs are drawn together. In terms of Zen practice, samadhi enables us, it gives us the strength to not allow the mind to scatter. The tendency of the mind, because of the way we've misused it for so long, the tendency of the mind is to scatter itself, scatter the attention. And it does take a certain degree of strength to hold it on the koan or the breath practice, whatever our practice is. And our zazen is both the cause of greater concentration and the effect of it. As we sit, say in sesshin, as the days go by, we find that our strength of concentration grows, and we're able to refrain from scattering our attention in all directions. This is why late in sesshin, it is so much easier to be concentrated. Samadhi is not the product of only of formal meditation. Any activity that really holds our attention, that really grips us, is a way of developing concentration, of samadhi. This is why when we get up from a good book, let's say, a really gripping book that we've been reading for an hour or two, and we get up from that, we can feel energized because it's absorbing. Same with anything we're doing, watching a movie or being involved in an intense discussion. Concentration is energizing. And then he goes on, if you do not stabilize yourself in the quietness of samadhi, your activating consciousness will drift about without a foundation. When you are near death, wind and fire will oppress you. When the four elements separate and scatter, that is, when you die, when the physical body passes, the mind will go wild, burning with sadness, and become subject to inverted thinking and distorted views. You will cower in fright, bereft of all you used to rely on. Your body will be left behind to decay as if it were the slough of a cicada. Confused about the way which stretches far into the distance, your solitary spirit will have to go on alone. Although you have gems, wealth, and priceless jewelry, you cannot carry any of it away with you. Although you may be from an aristocratic household and have many relatives, not one of them can follow behind and look after you. This is what is meant by what one makes for oneself, one receives for oneself. Or in modern version is that is what goes around comes around. There is no one who can take your place. At that time, what discernment do you have to bridge the sea of suffering? Well, as we've said so many times from this seat, this practice of zazen, and especially sesshin, is absolutely terrific training in dying. In its training in keeping the mind calm and centered in the face of all kinds of mental phenomena that might rise up in the mind. We actually have periods, most of us have periods like this in sesshin, where we get assailed by makkyo, images or strong emotions, fear, anxiety, other kinds of bedeviling thoughts. It's like a kind of a storm that we can get caught in during sesshin. And how we handle ourselves in such a storm predicts how we will navigate our way through this bardo, this intermediate realm that follows the death of the physical body. in this intermediate realm, the bardo, we're in a very vulnerable state because the conscious mind is no longer functioning as we might have expected it to. That is, there's we can't bring forth reason or logic or other devices to settle the mind. So what we have is whatever capacity we've developed for not getting caught in these phenomena, these mental phenomena. Those who have no training in this are, of course, much more vulnerable. Much more vulnerable to fears and distress at such a state, in such a time. At that time, he asks, what discernment do you have to bridge the sea of suffering? He says, do not say that because you have a small portion of conditioned merit, you will be able to avoid this calamity. Master Po Chang said, even though you have merit, perspicacity, and vast learning, none of it will be able to save you. If your mind's eye has not yet opened, you have only conditioned thoughts which are involved in the sense spheres. You do not yet know how to look back on the radiance of the mind. So in other words, without awakening, one is more likely to get caught up in these mental objects that can be so troubling. With awakening, or I would say even with a long training, one has the presence of mind to recognize them as just mental formations, mental phenomena, and not get drawn into them. This is what we learn from dealing with makkyo. And seeing makkyo and seeing these phenomena as after death, we recognize their transitory nature. We know that they're just like a little dust storm in the mind, and that they will pass. But this Po Chang continues. Furthermore, as you have not yet seen the path to Buddhahood, at the time of death, all of your life's unwholesome actions appear before you, either alarming you or making you joyful. The six destinies, I guess that means the six realms of unenlightened existence, and the five aggregates appear before you. The five aggregates of the five skandhas. You see beautifully decorated houses, skiffs, boats, carts, and palanquins all shining brilliantly in the light of the self nature. These sights make your mind dissolute, so that the things you view with greed and lust are all transformed into pleasing objects. At the place where these things are most intense, you are reborn without one iota of choice in the matter. Whether as a dragon or an ox, whether of high or low status, nothing is certain. So it's our attachment to these mental phenomena in the bardo, our attachment that can vault us into an unfavorable rebirth. Now, this is just standard Buddhist teaching. It's not something I can confirm from experience, not having remembered dying. But I don't doubt for a minute that this same process of dealing with phenomena in the mind that we go through in Sesshin will happen after the release of death and slipping into unconsciousness. Therefore, now this is Chinu again, therefore those with superior understanding and enduring will should first contemplate deeply the incontrovertible relation between action and result throughout the three time periods, past, present, and future. There is no place to which you may escape. In other words, the immutable law of cause and effect is what he's talking about. If the conditions you create now are in error and your practice cannot advance, later you will have to receive the suffering due. This would certainly be miserable. Hence, in the first, middle, and last parts of the night, quietly forget all conditioning. Sit tall and straight. Do not cling to external signs. Concentrate the mind and reflect internally. First, subdue mental agitation with calmness. Then bring dullness under control with alertness. Control both dullness and scatteredness, but do not allow thoughts of grasping or rejecting. Clarify the mind. Let it be expansive and unobscured, free of thoughts, but aware. Be entirely unreceptive to visions or experiences which you do not tally with what you have learned in the Dharma. And then he quotes some text called One Night Enlightened. And this and here, it clarifies the relationship between dullness of mind as one error, and agitation of mind as the other. Calmness means not to think about anything good, bad, or neutral in the external sense spheres. Alertness means not to allow dullness, blankness, or any other sluggish state to arise. If there is calmness but no alertness, this is dullness. If there is alertness but no calmness, this is agitation. When there is neither calmness nor alertness, the mind is not merely agitated but also abides in dullness. When both calmness and alertness are present together, not only clarity, but also calmness are produced. This is the sublime nature which returns to the fountainhead of the mind. So these are the two dangers in meditation. One is slipping into a state of dullness, drowsiness, torpor, kind of a stupefied state. Surely everyone knows, has experienced this. And I think it's more common in the early stage, the first two or three days of Sesshin, sinking into this kind of torpor. And the other danger is restlessness or agitation, getting overly excited. What we want to navigate is the middle way, where there is an alert calmness. This is not something we have to think about. We don't have to strategize. Okay, let's see, how should I do this? Be calm but not dull, and alert but not agitated. We find our way there by strongly applying ourselves and going off in these two directions and bringing ourselves back. We find our way through making mistakes, by sinking into lethargy and realizing it and snapping out of it, or getting too excited and then realizing that and bringing the mind back. There's really no substitute for the direct experience of going through and going astray. This we all do, but eventually we find the middle ground, and this is the most effective way of working. Well, there's a lot more in this chapter called Encouragement to Practice, but not all that much that's suitable for Teisho. So I'm going to go to the next chapter, which is called Secrets on Cultivating the Mind. And the editor tells us that this is an outline of basic Zen practice written by Chinuo to instruct the throngs of people coming to the newly completed monastery. And it says this remains one of the most popular Zen texts in Korea today. He begins, "The triple world is blazing in defilement as if it were a house on fire. How can you bear to tarry here and complacently undergo such long suffering? If you wish to avoid wandering in samsara, there is no better way than to seek Buddhahood, enlightenment. If you want to become a Buddha, understand that Buddha is the mind. How can you search for the mind in the far distance? It is not outside the body. The physical body is a phantom, for it is subject to birth and death. The true mind is like space, for it neither ends nor changes. Therefore, it is said, these 100 bones will crumble and return to fire and wind, but one thing is eternally numinous and covers heaven and earth." Of course, that is this true nature that is beyond phenomena, the phenomena of the mind and the body. In a way, this describes the spiritual quest, is finding that which is beyond our ordinary state of consciousness, our ordinary experience. It's striving to apprehend what cannot be apprehended with our ordinary mind. What is beyond the world of phenomena? Certainly, this world that is beyond phenomena can't be described, because even words are phenomena. Everything's phenomena. So what transcends everything? What is Mu? What is it? Who am I? We have to recognize that in ancient China and Korea both, it seems that the most common misconception was that Buddha is this person or thing outside us. Here we could say that enlightenment, the idea of enlightenment as something beyond us, outside us, is the fundamental misconception, as if it's somewhere we have to get to, some place, some in some future time that we can strive for and eventually get to. This is delusion, that it's out there somewhere. It is our nature. Our true nature is enlightenment. We were born with it. We couldn't lose it if we tried. But until we know it, until we confirm it through awakening to it, then it's not functioning for us. It's not, in a way, it's not real. But nonetheless, it's not outside us. He continues, "It is tragic. People have been deluded for so long. They do not recognize that their own minds are the true Buddha. They do not recognize that their own natures are the true Dharma. They want to search for the Dharma, yet they still look far away for holy ones. They want to search for the Buddha, yet they will not observe their own minds. If they aspire to the path of Buddhahood while obstinately holding to their feeling that the Buddha is outside the mind, or the Dharma is outside the nature, then even though they pass through kalpas as numerous as dust motes, burning their bodies, charring their arms, crushing their bones, and exposing their marrow, or else write sutras with their own blood, never lying down to sleep, eating only one offering a day at the hour of the hare, which is 5 to 7 in the morning, or even studying through the entire Tripitaka and cultivating all sorts of ascetic practices is like trying to make rice by boiling sand. It will only add to their tribulation." Well, this thing about burning their bodies, charring their arms, crushing their bones, blah, blah, blah. This is, there is actually, I've heard of practices, monastic, ascetic practices of burning incense on the scalp and things like that. This other stuff, charring their arms, crushing their bones, this I think is getting into the realm of myth. Writing sutras with our own blood, this was a practice, a respected practice in ancient China and I suppose Korea. Never lying down to sleep, we're told that this there were those who did this as a form of self-denial, who would go for years without lying down to sleep. Sleep, there, it'd have to be sleep, of course, but it would be only sleep sitting up, never lying down. Eating only once a day, the breakfast, and so forth. He's saying all of these seemingly heroic practices won't do you a bit of good as long as you cling to the notion that awakening is something outside you. So enlightenment is a place you can get to. He goes on, if only they would understand their own minds, then, without searching, approaches to Dharma as numerous as the sands of the Ganges and uncountable sublime meanings would all be understood. The world-honored one said, I see that all sentient beings everywhere are endowed with the Buddha's wisdom and virtue. He also said, all the illusory guises in which sentient beings appear take shape in the sublime mind of the Tathagata's complete enlightenment. Tathagata is just how the Buddha referred to himself. And then Chino says, consequently, you should know that outside this mind there is no enlightenment which can be attained. All the Buddhas of the past were merely persons who understood their minds. All the sages of the present are likewise merely persons who have cultivated their minds. And all future meditators should rely on this Dharma as well. I hope that you who cultivate the path will never search outside. The nature of the mind is unstained. It is originally whole and complete in itself. If you will only leave behind false conditioning, you will be like a Buddha. So false conditioning begins with thoughts. Detaching from thoughts. And we know how to do that. Single-minded absorption in the practice. Well, this is a break point in the text, so we'll stop now and recite the four vows.